This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, Internet. Welcome to Quiz and Hers. I'm getting my ass beat this season.
Sorry, Justin.
I'm Justin. That mewling little voice you hear there is my wife, Hallie, who is destroying me on this season of the podcast.
Forgive me if I have no sympathy. You won so many seasons. I can't even keep track anymore.
I have 5 season championships. You have 4. Oh. So you might even it out.
It feels a lot worse.
No.
Okay. Then I just still don't feel bad because it's not like I have more. So.
Okay. Well, if you don't know what we're talking about, you're probably a first-time listener, so thanks for giving us a try. We're usually a little more high energy than this, but I am just beaten down right now.
I am so high energy, I am pumped and ready to go.
Yeah. So, the way this podcast works is each week, one of us writes 6 trivia questions to ask the other person, which are tied together by some common theme, and each question comes from one of our 6 categories, which are arts and literature, times and places, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. After each question, the person who wrote it will talk about the answer for a few minutes, so hopefully we all learn something new we didn't know before. And whoever has the most correct answers at the end of the season is the season 10 champion.
Yep.
And right now, Hallie is kicking my ass.
Yep.
17-10 on the season.
Yep.
I have a chance today to try to close that gap. What do you got?
All right, this game is a symbolic game, literally.
What?
It's about symbols.
That's broad and vague.
I guess. It's just about symbols. Symbols for things. Symbols. Why not?
All right, whatever.
I could be broad and vague as I want.
Okay.
Last I checked.
Mm-hmm.
Question 1 is everything else. Caduceus, the symbol that is often incorrectly used as a symbol of healthcare organizations, is actually a symbol of what Greek god who is said to carry the staff to make people fall asleep or wake up or make peace between adversaries?
Hermes.
Yep.
I almost said Mercury, but that's the Roman one, so it's Hermes.
Yes, it's Hermes.
Okay.
We're going to talk about Hermes.
Nice.
Hermes is the herald and messenger of the gods in Greek mythology. He is also the protector of human heralds, travelers, merchants, thieves, and orators. He is also a psychopomp, or soul guide, which conducts souls into the afterlife.
Psychopomp?
Yeah, it's like my new favorite word.
That's phenomenal. I've never heard that word.
So apparently the Greek word for like someone who guides people into the afterlife or souls into the afterlife is called a psychopomp.
That's amazing.
But I like really want to call a person that and be like, you're such a psychopomp. And they're going to have no idea what I'm talking about.
But you'd be using the term incorrectly.
I know, but like, isn't that a great insult even though
no,
it just is meaningless?
It sounds like an insult, but it doesn't. It clearly isn't.
What is the meaning of a word anyway?
It's what it means.
Yeah, but like,
no.
Didn't someone say that like, is it fuck or is it shit that like could be used in all these different contexts and has like, is like 5 different parts of speech and stuff? You know, like I could just do whatever I want.
This was, you're thinking of the episode of our buddy Rory Spence's podcast Dog Hair Presents where he talks about the history of profanity.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite hours of podcast content ever.
Yep.
But yes, the word fuck can be used as like any part of speech and yep. to mean like almost anything.
So I think can't we make psychopomp the new fuck?
I don't think psychopomp can mean anything, though.
It could just mean you're a psychopomp.
All right.
You're such a psychopomp.
All right. You can try to get that started.
I will.
All right.
Other than his main symbol, the caduceus, Hermes' other symbols include the tortoise, rooster, satchel, winged helmet, goat, palm tree, the number 4, certain kinds of fish, and incense. Lots of symbols.
Many symbols, yes.
Yes. In Roman mythology, Hermes was known as Mercury, which comes from the Latin merx for merchandise.
Right, because he was also like, he was the god of like traders and such.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Homer and Hesiod portrayed Hermes as a benefactor of mortals and the author of skilled or deceptive acts. In the Iliad, he was a divine ally of the Greeks against the Trojans. The character Odysseus in the Odyssey was Hermes' great-grandson, and Hermes helps him by telling him that his companions were turned into animals by Circe. For more details, you can listen to my summary of the Odyssey in my Straits episode, which was a long time ago.
Or don't, because it's real long.
My summary?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's better than reading the Odyssey.
As someone who's done both, yes, I can attest to that.
I have not. In Hesiod's The Works and Days, Zeus orders Hephaestus to create Pandora to disgrace humanity by punishing Prometheus for giving fire to man. Hermes' gifts to her were lies, seductive words, and dubious character. For more info on that, you can listen to my summary of the Pandora story in my Same Name Game episode, which was not that long ago.
No, it was like last season or something? Maybe two seasons ago? Something like that?
Yeah. The Homeric Hymn 4 to Hermes is a collection of 33 ancient Greek hymns from an anonymous source. They are just called Homeric because they use the same meter as the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Right, yeah, I've heard of that.
They tell the story of Hermes' birth and portray him as a thief. Hermes was also believed to have invented the sport of wrestling, making him a patron of athletes.
Never heard that before, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Hermes was described as having several different lovers. Peitho, the goddess of seduction and persuasion, was said to be his wife. Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty and love, was also wooed by Hermes, but rejected him. Hermes asked Zeus to help him get her, and Zeus sent his eagle to take Aphrodite's sandal and gave it to Hermes. Then, when Aphrodite found him to get her sandal, he made love to her, and she had a child named Hermaphroditus. So basically, Zeus facilitated his daughter's rape.
As he did, yes.
Not great.
Aphrodite was not his daughter, at least in some versions of the myth.
All right, fine.
Sometimes she was, sometimes
she
wasn't.
Okay, well, he facilitated her rape regardless.
Yeah. Well, that was Zeus for you.
Guess so. Hermes also fell in love with Apemosyne, a princess of Crete, who he also seems to have raped. He also liked, I don't know how to pronounce this, C-H-I-O-N-E. Chione? Kyone?
Kyone, something like that.
Sure. Who was a princess of Phokis, who he put to sleep with his wand and then raped. Not great. Hermes was mainly worshipped as a chthonic deity, C-H-T-H-O-N.
Right, a god of death or the underworld.
Right, which was a god who was associated with earth and or underworld.
Yeah.
He was also a fertility god, and the phallus was one of his symbols.
Yeah, okay.
His feast was called Hermeia, and was celebrated with sacrifices to the gods and with athletic events. The events were like initiations because only young boys could participate. That's a weird place to end, but that's it.
Oh. All right, then.
Sorry, that was abrupt.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. That's all I have to say about Hermes.
Okay.
Okay. Question 2. Times and places. The swastika symbol was adopted by the Nazi Party before World War II to symbolize German nationalistic pride. But the symbol originally comes from Hinduism, with the word swastika meaning conducive to well-being in what language?
Probably Sanskrit. Could be Hindi, but... No, it's gotta be Sanskrit.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Sanskrit.
Okay.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about the Holocaust.
All right.
Because it's important.
It is.
I don't want to, but I will.
Okay.
I mean, it's not fun, but whatever.
All right.
So, obviously, for most of history, Jews have been subjected to anti-Semitism. In the late 19th century, the Volkisch movement began, which viewed Jews as enemies of the Aryan race vying for world domination. The Nazi Party originated as an offshoot of the Volkisch movement and ultimately seized power when Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany in 1933. The rise of the Nazis divided the population into two groups. I didn't know about this. The Volksgenossen, who were national comrades who belonged to the Volksgemeinschaft, which is like the group.
The broader apparatus of the Nazi Party.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Gemeinschaftsfremd, which means community aliens.
So non-Nazis?
Yes.
Okay.
The Nazis divided enemies into three groups. Racial enemies like the Jews and Roma, political opponents of Nazism, and moral opponents like gay men and criminals. They wanted to put the political and moral opponents in concentration camps for re-education, but they believed racial enemies had to be completely removed from society. Throughout the 1930s, they slowly but steadily restricted the rights of Jews. They were excluded from civil service, disbarred from practicing law, editing or running newspapers, and owning farms. They were also forced to sell their businesses to Germans in a process called Aryanization. Jewish doctors were forced to resign, and works by Jewish composers, authors, and artists were excluded from publications, performances, and exhibitions. In 1933, they passed a sterilization law, and roughly 300,000 to 400,000 involuntary sterilizations occurred during the Third Reich.
Jeez.
Yeah. But it gets worse.
Yeah, I know where this is going.
I know, but I meant to look this up before I talked about this. Like, I keep seeing articles that are like, the Holocaust isn't being taught anymore and stuff like that, so...
That's definitely not true.
I'm sure most of our listeners know most things about it, but yeah. I feel like there are some trivia relevant things that people might not know. So.
Okay.
In 1935, they passed the Nuremberg Laws, which said that only those of German or kindred blood could be citizens and that marriages between Jews and those of German blood were forbidden. So those were the Nuremberg Laws.
Yeah, okay.
Like, that might be important to
me. Yeah, I've never heard that before, so.
Yeah. Even though the laws specified Jews, they also applied to the Roma and Black Germans. By the end of 1938, about half the German Jewish population had left.
Well, yeah. Reasonably so.
Yeah. In 1938, Nazi Germany annexed Austria in what was called the Anschluss. Also a good thing to know.
Anschluss.
Yes, Anschluss. And about 100,000 Austrian Jews left the country by 1939, including Sigmund Freud and his family. They went to London, if you're wondering. On November 9th and 10th, 1938, attacks occurred on over 7,500 Jewish shops and over 1,000 synagogues were damaged or destroyed in what was called Kristallnacht, or Night of Broken Glass.
Yeah.
That week, 30,000 Jews were sent to Buchenwald, Dachau, and Sachsenhausen concentration camps. The camps already existed as places of unlawful incarceration of political opponents. Before World War II, the German government and the Zionist Federation of Germany agreed that Jews could emigrate to British Palestine, and about 53,000 German Jews moved there, which is also a fact that I did not know.
No, I didn't know that either. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. After Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, they concentrated Jews in ghettos. By early 1941, the Warsaw Ghetto contained 445,000 people. It had 30% of the city's population and 2.5% of its area, with over 9 people per room.
Jeez.
Yeah. Then Germany invaded France, Yugoslavia, Greece, and the Soviet Union. I'm not going to get into like the details of that because that's not really relevant right now. We'll do like some sort of World War II discussions. You have to break it into a million things. This is just like one piece of like a huge thing to talk about.
There's a lot of history in World War II, yes.
Yeah. After war broke out in 1939, new concentration camps were established, many of which were outside Germany in occupied Europe. Most of the
including Alderney,
yes,
in the Channel
as
Islands.
We learned last
strangely.
Week. Yeah, very weird.
Yeah.
Most of the prisoners were not actually German.
Right, yeah.
After 1942, the camps became more brutal and the death rates increased. Prisoners were killed more frequently and were beat and starved. There was a policy called Vernichtung durch Arbeit, I don't know if I said that right, or extermination through labor, where inmates would literally be worked until they died. The average lifespan in the camps was 3 months from lack of food, epidemics, and punishments for minor transgressions. Prisoners had to wear colored triangles on their uniforms. Red was for political prisoners, purple was for Jehovah's Witnesses, black and green were for, quote, asocials and criminals.
What does that mean?
I think it was just people that they deemed, like, deviant or whatever.
I see. Okay.
Pink was for gay men, and two yellow triangles to make a six-pointed star was for Jews.
Right, yeah, very famously.
Yeah. In addition, prisoners in Auschwitz were tattooed upon their arrival to the camp. I kind of thought that was everywhere. I didn't realize it was just Auschwitz.
I wonder why.
From what I read, I think they all kind of had their own, like, I don't know what you want to call it, like, leadership?
Well, sure, yeah. Okay.
They weren't all being run the same.
Okay.
Which
yeah.
I'll say more about.
Okay.
At the end of 1941, Germans began building more camps and expanding existing ones. Auschwitz was expanded by building Auschwitz II Birkenau, however you want to say it.
Birkenau, yeah.
Nearby. I didn't realize that Birkenau was like part of Auschwitz or related.
Yeah, I think I knew that.
By spring 1942, gas chambers had been installed in the new camps. Almost all Jews at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka were sent straight to the gas chambers. To prevent panic, they were told that the chambers were showers or delousing chambers. Okay, I'm good. I'm fine. Sorry. After the chambers, workers who were other Jewish prisoners had to carry out the bodies, extract gold fillings, cut off women's hair, and remove jewelry, artificial limbs, and glasses. At the end of 1942, some resistance groups were formed in Poland, such as the Jewish Combat Organization and Jewish Military Union in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943 held the SS at bay for 4 weeks. In 1942 and 43, most of the Jewish ghettos were liquidated and shipped their populations to concentration camps for extermination. The first major camp that Allied troops reached was Majdanek in July 1944. Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec were never liberated but were destroyed by Germans in 1943. In January 1945, Auschwitz inmates were sent on a death march, and by the time it was liberated by the Soviets, there were only about 7,000 inmates. Buchenwald, Dachau, and Mauthausen were liberated by the Americans, and Bergen-Belsen was liberated by the British. About one-third of the world's Jews and two-thirds of Europe's Jews were killed, totaling about 6 million.
Yeah.
I've decided not to talk about the aftermath, like the Nuremberg trials and stuff, but that could be its own discussion.
Yeah, it certainly could.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I thought you were going to talk about Sanskrit.
No. I thought about it, but I didn't think that was times and places.
I guess it would depend on the direction you came at it from, but
I guess. But this seemed important. So.
It's certainly important.
This seemed more important. I don't know. Whatever. It's important. I had to do it eventually.
Okay.
And I did. And now we will move on and stop being sad.
All right, that's done.
Okay. Out of the way. Question 3, movies and TV. What TV show that premiered in 2008 showed a glyph, a type of symbol, before each commercial to represent some of the ways that Dr. Walter Bishop solves a case in the episode? You were with me for the first half.
I was, but wait, what?
Now I want to know what you thought it was.
I thought it was going to be Fringe, because I remember I watched a couple seasons of that, and they always showed these weird pictures before the commercials.
Okay.
But they weren't really glyphs, they were like pictures of stuff. And I don't remember a Walter Bishop character.
Okay.
But then again, I only watched a couple seasons because it was real bad, but I don't know. Fringe.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But they weren't glyphs, they were like pictures.
They're called glyphs.
Stupid fucking J.J.
Abrams. I also googled what a glyph is, and it's a symbol, so.
It's a symbol, but they were like photographs, they were like apples and frogs and stuff.
I don't know, they described them as glyphs.
Okay.
The fans in the show called them glyphs.
Stupid fucking J.J. Abrams, man.
Regardless, they are symbols.
Okay, I suppose they are symbols.
So, Fringe is an American sci-fi TV series created by J.J. Abrams, Alex Kurtzman, and Roberto Orci.
Ugh.
It ran on Fox from 2008 to 2013. Abrams' inspiration for the show came from the writings of Michael Crichton, films from David Cronenberg, and the shows The X-Files and The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, this was X-Files, except not good, basically.
I don't know, I've never seen it. For the show, they decided to combine a procedural show like Law & Order with a serialized and culty show like Lost. The serialization aspect applied to the growth and development of the characters, but they hoped that the viewers could still tune in for standalone episodes.
Yeah.
The show follows the casework of the Fringe Division, a joint federal task force supported by the FBI. The main characters are Agent Olivia Dunham, played by Anna Torv, Dr. Walter Bishop, the archetypal and mad scientist, played by John Noble, and Peter Bishop, Walter's son, played by Joshua Jackson.
I didn't remember the name of the character. I remember John Noble was in it.
Yeah, he was Walter Bishop.
Okay. He might have been maybe the best part of that show?
I don't know. I've never seen it. I believe you.
Yeah.
They are supported by Philip Broyles, the force's director, played by Lance Reddick, and Agent Astrid Farnsworth, Walter's assistant, played by Jessica Nicole.
I take it back. Lance Reddick was the best part of that show, and it wasn't close, now that I think about it.
I don't really know who that is.
He's the really, really tall, cue ball, shaved, very dark-skinned black actor. You've seen him.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, you know who he is. He's great. I don't know why he's not in more stuff. He's fantastic. And he was really good in that show, which was not very good.
Nope, I was thinking of someone else. But now I want to know who I was thinking of. I don't know him.
Lance Reddick's really good.
He was on Oz and Lost and John Wick. And he's from Baltimore.
He's in John Wick, isn't he? That's a good movie. He should be in more stuff. He's good.
Okay, I don't know. The division investigates cases related to fringe science, like transhumanist experiments gone wrong and the possible collision of two parallel universes.
Like I said, it's the X-Files, but not good.
Okay. Their work often overlaps with the work of a biotech company called Massive Dynamic, which was founded by Walter's former partner, Dr. William Bell, played by Leonard Nimoy.
Nimoy.
I know. I don't know why I said Nimoy.
Good God.
I know it's Leonard Nimoy. Anyway, it's run by their mutual friend, Nina Sharp, played by Blair Brown.
The part where you said Leonard Nimoy?
Yeah, where I had a brain fart moment.
We'll see.
I know it's Nimoy. Come on. Apparently, there is a group of bald, pale, white men called the Observers who watch the group silently.
I remember that.
And I've decided that that is clear plagiarism of Marvel's Watchers, but whatever.
Yes, that's correct.
I know, right?
Except these are much less alien-looking. They're just, like, bald dudes, but yes, you're right.
But come on!
You're 100% right.
Yeah. I know, right?
Yeah.
The show also included a lot of storylines about an alternate universe that mirrors our universe, but with certain differences.
Which is just plagiarizing Star Trek. The mirror universe.
Yeah. Like I mentioned in the question, they showed brief images of glyphs prior to commercial breaks. Abrams said in an interview that they had a hidden meaning. The code was actually cracked by an editor at the technology site Ars Technica, who said it was a simple substitution cipher to spell out a single thematic word for each episode. For example, the pilot episode's glyphs spell out the word observer. Early reception of the show was lukewarm, with people saying it had a lackluster start and dull characters.
Agreed.
After the first season, though, changes in their approach led to a more positive reception. Overall, the show was well-received by critics and developed a cult following. The show was nominated for Emmy Awards, Golden Reel Awards for sound editing, Saturn Awards for science fiction, Satellite Awards, and Writers Guild of America Awards. Of all of them, they only won at the Saturn Awards.
Okay. Not a great show.
No idea.
All right. Well, then that brings us to halftime. So, this is when we take a break. First, to thank you guys for listening. We're really happy that you're spending a little time with us. We hope you've learned something new so far. We hope that extensive discussion of the Holocaust wasn't too much.
It was a lot, but now we're over the hump.
Well, you followed it up with Fringe, which is almost as bad. I'm kidding. But anyway, yeah, thanks for sticking around. We hope you're enjoying the show, despite the content today so far. If you are enjoying the show, please be sure to give us a like and a subscribe and a rating and a review in your preferred podcast platform. It really does help us out. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can email us. We are quizandhers@gmail.com. And we are also at quizandhers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you want to give us a follow over there and get in touch with us that way. Send us your submissions for Fact or Fucked. We always appreciate having those. We'll get to that later in the show. And we are, of course, proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network, as you heard at the top of the show. So check out bigheadsmedia.com. You can find Quizandhers merchandise there, as well as a plethora of other podcasts.
Yep.
And so now we're going to hear a quick word from one of those other podcasts from the Big Heads Media Podcast Network.
You have to watch it. It's so good.
It was all right.
Your friends may have decent taste in movies, but their incoherent reviews are getting annoying.
I don't know. I just didn't like it.
Looking for a new podcast?
Join Time Sensitive, where we break down the recent movies you've heard of but may have missed.
Spoilers included.
And we get it. You're busy and can't see everything, but are you really going to track it down a year later?
We take the time so you don't have to.
Find us on Twitter, @TSMoviePod, and find out what we're watching.
I'm Sam.
I'm Ian.
And I'm Kate, and we're three friends and armchair movie critics. Seriously, invite us into your living
room. Kate, stop.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Time Sensitive, because you deserve better.
All right, we're back. I'm 3 for 3.
Yep.
Sweet. All right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Over to you.
All right. Question 4, sports and games. The symbol of what Big Four sports team is the team name and 3 hypocycloids in primary colors surrounded by a gray circle?
Oh, this is going to get ugly.
I'm sorry. I told you that the depressing part was over, but I lied.
This is going to get real, real ugly.
This was like Hallie's masochism game,
yeah,
or something. I don't know.
We always say we don't get political on this podcast, but we get real football-y. And
yep.
We fucking hate the Pittsburgh Steelers. But that's a very well-written question, I must say.
I know, I liked it. It's a real symbol because a hypocycloid is like a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Because like other teams just have logos, but this is like a symbol.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Fucking Steelers.
I know. Like, I wrote all these discussions and I left the Steelers and then the Holocaust.
So it's funny. This episode, we're recording this episode the week after the Ravens lost to the Steelers at home in week eight of the season.
Jeez, it's already been 8 weeks.
I know. And so that wound is still very raw for us right now.
Yeah, so I really could not write this discussion until the game had passed by for a few days because, like, I almost thought of writing it during the game, but I was like, I can't do this to myself.
No. But here's the thing. This will come out after they have played again on Thanksgiving. So we will either be in a much better mood if the Ravens win in Pittsburgh, or we will be even more heartbroken if they lose and
hopefully they'll go win.
Two games behind them in the AFC North. So,
oh, God.
All right.
But it's important.
We have to do it.
Yeah.
And they are one of the more historically important football teams. I will admit that. And they have a massive fan diaspora across the United States.
Which we don't.
Small market team, only been around 25 years. No, we really don't.
But we love you.
We're Ravens fans, for those of you not following this, but I think everyone who listens to this podcast knows that by now. But
probably. Justin's in his Ravens shirt.
I am.
I will be soon.
All right.
Okay. The Pittsburgh Steelers of the NFL started...
Boo! Fuck you! Sorry.
I can't do this. Sorry. I can't do this.
Sorry.
The Pittsburgh
Steelers... Boo! Fuck you!
I can't do this.
All right, I'll stop.
Okay. I'm afraid now. This is like the dog when you fake throw the ball a few times and then they're just like, I don't want to. That's me right now. Okay. The Pittsburgh Steelers of the NFL started out as the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1933, losing 23-2 to the New York Giants. The team was owned by Art Rooney and the team's nickname was the Rooney Men. Before the 1940 season, they renamed themselves the Steelers. During World War II, they had to merge with other NFL franchises twice because of player shortages.
The Steagles, right?
Yeah. In 1943, they merged with the Philadelphia Eagles and were called the Steagles.
Not officially, I don't think, though.
No, unofficially.
They were just like...
They were called that.
Right, but they were just like...
Sorry,
officially,
they weren't officially called.
Officially, they were just like the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh
Oh, shit. No, I had the... There was a name, but it wasn't the Steagles.
Oh, really? I didn't think there was a name. I just thought they were just like the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh franchise. I didn't think there was actually a real name.
Hang on.
Okay. Yeah, go check. That's interesting.
I don't know why I didn't write it.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be a good fact.
The Phil Pitt Eagles.
Wow.
Yep. Not great.
No. Okay.
In 1944, they emerged with the Chicago Cardinals, and they finished 0-10, the only winless team in franchise history. Their only playoff game before the AFL-NFL merger was against the Eagles in 1947, which they lost 21-0. Ha ha. Sorry. Can't help myself.
No. We're allowed to have strong opinions on football on this podcast.
It's fine. Sorry to any of you who are Steelers fans, but whatever.
We just turn into a Ravens podcast every once in a while anyway, so.
Sorry. Yeah. At this time, they played at Forbes Field, which they shared with the Pittsburgh Pirates. During the AFL-NFL merger in 1970, the Steelers were one of three old guard NFL teams to switch to the new American Football Conference.
Right.
Do you know what the other two were?
Ooh. I think one of them was the Redskins, who are now back in the NFC.
Nope.
Really? I could have sworn that was one of them.
No, it was the Cleveland Browns and the Baltimore Colts.
Really?
So they all went to the same division, which makes a lot of sense. The year before, they hired Coach Chuck Knoll, who drafted Mean Joe Green, Terry Bradshaw, Mel Blunt?
I think so.
And Franco Harris.
Mm-hmm.
In 1974, he drafted four Hall of Famers in 1 year. Lynn Swann, Jack Lambert, John Stallworth, and Mike Webster. In the 1970s, they made the playoffs in 8 seasons and became the only NFL team ever to win 4 Super Bowls in 6 years. I know. Once the 80s began, they stopped doing so well due to injuries and retirements of the early players.
Right.
In 1988, Art Rooney, the owner, died, and his son Dan took over as owner.
And still is to this day, I believe.
No.
No? Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay.
The next time the team made the playoffs was 1989, but they only got to the second round. Sorry.
Okay.
Chuck Knoll retired in 1992 after over 20 years as coach and was succeeded by Bill Cowher, a Pittsburgh native. In Cowher's first six seasons, the Steelers went to the playoffs every year. They went to Super Bowl 30 in 1995, but lost to the Dallas Cowboys.
I remember that one. I was old enough. I was old enough at this point, and I was raised by Cowboys fans, despite being a Ravens fan now. So I absolutely remember that.
That would be so weird if you were a Cowboys fan.
Yeah.
If you were a Cowboys fan, I would probably be a Cowboys fan.
Probably.
I don't like it.
I mean, I have nothing against the Cowboys. They're not a good team right now.
I don't know if I could have done that.
Mostly through no fault of their own, but
even though I didn't really like football, I called myself a Giants fan. You're I don't think I could become a Cowboys
Giants
fan.
Fair enough.
At least like a Ravens fan is like the totally other conference. Mm-hmm. And also like the purple thing really helped convince me.
All right.
Okay. And now I'm a crazy person.
So and the fact that they have a marching band. That was the thing that actually sold you on them.
Yes, the marching band. The purple and the marching band. Yes. And
okay.
The Edgar Allan Poe thing is cool.
That's a good connection.
And now I'm a crazy person who nearly hyperventilates. It's fine.
Yeah, Hallie has like 8 heart attacks during every Ravens game now.
It's cool.
That's good.
I blame genetics for that.
Yeah, well.
My family are very crazy.
Yes, your family are, I wouldn't call
mostly
them
about
hardcore sports fans, but when they are into a sporting event, they go 170%.
But like, so my grandfather was a hardcore sports fan.
He was,
like,
but even your mom,
if a game of any big four sports team that he liked was on, he was watching it,
right,
which took up most of the time.
Right. But like, even your mom, who is like not a huge sports fan, like she's a fan of the New York Rangers, and when she watches Rangers games, I have never seen someone have this kind of mental break before. So,
well, she literally like stopped cold turkey because it was like affecting her mental health.
Yes. So that's
which
that's
I could see happening to me at some point, but hopefully I will keep it together.
You are never stopping watching Ravens games as long as you're married to me.
She once hyperventilated, and I really thought I was going to hyperventilate during that Steelers game last week, so now I'm a little concerned.
I hate to tell you, as long as we're married, the Ravens are going to be on every Sunday, so
I need to just find a way to meditate or something. I don't know. You'll help me, I guess.
Anyway, that's the kind of New York sports family that Hallie comes from, so
it's fine. I still stuck to all my New York teams except the Ravens. The Ravens was my one concession, even though Justin would not convert to being a Rangers fan, which
go
I'm
Caps.
Still bitter about. Stupid Caps. Okay. 10 years later, in Super Bowl 40, Cowher got his first Super Bowl win and the Steelers' 5th Super Bowl win by beating the Seattle Seahawks. They were the first 6th-seeded playoff team to reach the Super Bowl since the NFL expanded to a 12-team postseason tournament in 1990.
That's a good fact.
Yep. In 2001, the team moved to Heinz Field, where they still play today. In 2007, Cowher resigned as coach, and Mike Tomlin was announced as his successor. In 2009, he led the team to the Super Bowl and won against the Arizona Cardinals. Wow, I can't remember a time when the Cardinals were, like, good enough to go to the Super Bowl.
Well, they were massive underdogs.
Okay.
They were, like, a 5th seed or something. I remember that one very vividly. Heartbreaking game.
I don't think I really paid attention that year. Anyway. At age 36, Mike Tomlin was the youngest head coach to win the Super Bowl. In 2010, they went to the Super Bowl again, but lost to the Green Bay Packers.
That's right.
That I watched.
Yeah.
They've continued to have winning seasons since then, but haven't made the Super Bowl. In 2017, Dan Rooney died and his son Art Rooney II became the
That's
owner.
That's right, yeah.
The Steelers have also been strong advocates for civil rights. They were the first NFL team to hire an African-American assistant coach, to start an African-American quarterback, to have an African-American MVP, and to hire an African-American coordinator. They were also the first team to hire a female as a full-time athletic trainer.
Interesting.
As much as I hate them, I like Mike Tomlin. Like,
I can't help myself. I like Mike Tomlin a lot. He's a very, very good coach. He seems like a really, really great guy. I just wish he was coaching any other NFL
team. He's very, like, calm.
He's very, like, yeah, he's very zen, he's very focused. I like that about him.
But I really just cannot stand Ben Roethlisberger. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, fuck that.
Moving on.
Fuck that guy.
Oh, I was trying to get through this whole discussion without even saying his name, but I didn't. So, like I said in the question, their logo is the team name and 3 hypocycloids in primary colors surrounded by a gray circle. A hypocycloid is like a circle, but if you, like, inverted the arcs. That's the best way I can describe it.
I would describe it as a diamond if you shaved off the edges into, like, curves.
Yeah, sure.
Same thing.
It is based on the steel mark that was originally designed by Pittsburgh's U.S. Steel. That was the company.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I knew the team name came from, like, Pittsburgh being the steel city, right? Yeah. Like, a city of industry and smelting and stuff. I didn't realize that the logo had to do with that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And the team's colors are black and gold. They're the only NFL team that only puts their logo on one side of their helmet.
Yep.
Randomly.
Correct.
Apparently, they just tried it and then they decided to keep it.
Yeah.
They and the New York Giants are the only NFL teams to have the players' numbers on the fronts and backs of their helmets, which I never noticed. I tried looking it up and I couldn't find it, but I guess I'd have to look up, like, actual footage.
Wait, so the Steelers and who? The Giants?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so, actually.
I can't even picture
it. I never thought of that, but yeah, actually. Okay. Sure.
In 2007, they announced Steely McBeam as their official mascot.
Awful.
Yep. And they are also known for the terrible towel, a yellow towel, which is waved by fans at the games.
Yep.
And it is genuinely very terrible. The end.
I doubt we have any Steelers fan listeners because we have almost no listeners of any
kind.
We
don't now. If we did before.
If we did, we absolutely don't anymore. But yeah. It's okay. We have almost no listeners of any kind anyway. So statistically, it's improbable. But
yes, but think of it on the bright side. We like Mike Tomlin, and I talked about it.
Mike Tomlin is great. Sure. I respect the hell out of him. I dare say I like him, despite the fact that he's associated with the team that I despise more than any team in pro sports, but yes.
Yeah.
And really, it's because we respect them, because they're a very, very good team, and they're always in the way of the Ravens, and it's the best rivalry in pro sports. And
they're undefeated right now. They're the only undefeated team in the NFL.
I respect them. I don't like them, but I respect them. And it's the best rivalry in pro sports, no question about it. So
I think so.
Well, it's one of the only rivalries where the animosity is, like, actually very genuine between the players.
Yeah, there's fights every time.
Every single time they play each other, there is at least one fight. This isn't hockey,
it's
football.
Yeah, and one of our players got disqualified for contacting an official.
Yeah, that was bad.
Because he accidentally touched a ref when they were trying to, like,
to break
grab
up the fight.
Him.
Oh, yeah, that was bad.
It was an accident.
But he still should have been thrown out.
I know,
it is
but
zero
he did
tolerance.
Not intend to do that.
It doesn't matter. It is zero tolerance if you contact an official. And so, yeah, it sucks, but
it was crazy.
It's, yeah. You better have, like, fucking unicorns and rainbows in these last two questions.
The second to last one is whatever. The last one is more fun.
Okay.
All right. Question 5 is arts and literature. What configuration of symbols is used in Eastern religions as a map representing deities? And in New Age beliefs, as a chart that represents the cosmos.
Like a zodiac or something?
Is that your answer?
I guess.
No. It's mandala.
Damn it, I thought of that. But I didn't...
Oh, well, you can't win them all.
I didn't know what it was, so I didn't answer it.
I'm gonna tell you. It's weird, because, like, this isn't really art, but it's also art, so, you know.
Yeah, this could have been everything else, but all right.
Yeah, but it became art, so now it's art.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about mandalas in relation to the religions and different kinds of things like that. In Hinduism, a mandala is typically a square containing a circle with a center point. A yantra is a smaller mandala with a smaller color palette. Each yantra calls the deity into presence of the practitioner. They are not representations, but are lived and experiential to bring together the outer world and man's inner world.
All right. I don't really know what that means.
It's
but
like
okay.
It's like a thing that you look at. And it's like not to represent something. It's like actually a thing that you're like connecting.
Right.
With.
It's sort of meditative almost.
Yes.
Okay.
Which I'll get into more with Buddhism.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
In Vajrayana Buddhism, mandalas have also been developed into sand paintings.
Yeah, those are cool. I've seen those. They're amazing.
Yeah, so sand painting is the art of pouring colored sands onto a surface to make a fixed or unfixed painting.
Vajrayana Buddhism, by the way, also known as Tibetan Buddhism. We've talked about this.
Yes.
Because I talked about Buddhism.
Yes.
I don't remember when.
A while ago.
Oh, it was It was the penultimate countdown episode.
Right.
Because the Four Noble Truths. That's right. So if you want to learn about Buddhism, go listen to that one. Anyway.
The Buddhist mandalas are unfixed and are meant to be a meditation on impermanence. The sand is brushed together into a pile and spilled into a body of running water to spread the blessings of the mandala. In Vajrayana Buddhism, the mandala represents the nature of the pure land, enlightened mind. Another example of this is Vajrabhairava mandala, a silk tapestry woven with gilded paper which gives the piece a 3D effect. Kind of cool. A Buddhist mandala can also represent the entire universe. Another well-known type of mandala is the mandala of the five Buddhas, which depicts various aspects of enlightenment. One type is the five wisdom Buddhas, aka five jhanas. That one, paired with the five wisdom kings, forms the mandala of the two realms. In Buddhism, mandalas are meant to aid in meditation. They are meant to be contemplated to the point at which the image of it is completely internalized until even the smallest detail can be summoned.
Hmm.
Tantras...
Much like trivia. Like studying trivia. You should know every detail of everything.
There you go. It's like studying anything.
Yeah.
It's meditating on it.
Yeah.
Tantras instruct practitioners on how the mandala should be drawn and indicates the mantras to be recited during the ritual. Mandalas are often used in architecture to plan the design for Buddhist structures. In Mayan civilizations, they represented calendars in a form similar to a mandala.
Yeah, I guess so.
The Mayan symbology made its way into New Age symbolism as the dream spell calendar. I don't know more about that.
Hmm.
The Aztecs also had a mandala with the sunstone, which you could probably picture.
Yep.
Some of the circles of glyphs are glyphs for days of the month. It is believed that the center of the stone represents Tonatia, the Aztec deity of the sun.
Makes sense.
Some examples of mandalas in Christianity are the Celtic cross, the rosary, and the crown of thorns. Mandalas were actually reintroduced into modern Western thought by Carl Jung.
Yeah, that tracks.
He made mandalas to explore the unconscious.
So, remind me again, what is the technical definition of a mandala you're using here? Just a spiritual or religious, like, geometric symbol?
Yeah, it's like, it has some sort of, I don't know if you would necessarily say it 100% has, like, radial symmetry or whatever, mm-hmm. but it has some sort of symmetry like that.
Okay, because just someone who grew up in a very Christian household, I don't think any Christian would refer to a Celtic cross or a crown of thorns as a mandala. Like, that's a foreign term to that tradition.
Yeah, of course.
But you're using it in this sort of technical, scholarly sense.
But as someone who's really into, like, coloring and drawing and stuff and reads a lot about it, like, that's, like, a big thing. Like, just, like, drawing a mandala is thought of as being, like, meditative.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And it's fun.
Yeah. Much like reading the capitals of every country in the world over and over.
Sure. I mean, deeply meditative. I find it a little more enjoyable, but it's fun. Just to, like, draw something with that kind of symmetry is very, like, I don't know, calming.
All right.
Another fun one, which you could consider a mandala, are the scientific phylogenetic mandalas that represent evolutionary history.
Oh, the circular evolutionary tree diagram.
They call them mandalas,
too. Okay. Yeah, sure. I see that.
Yep. That's basically it.
Okay.
Kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah, cool.
All right, question 6, music. The symbol on the cover of what artist's 12th album, later called Love Symbol No. 2, incorporated the initial letters of the ancient Greek names of the classical planets Mars, Venus, and Mercury?
I mean, it has to be Prince. Because he later changed his name to said symbol somehow, which I still don't understand, like, how you do that from a legal standpoint, but it's gotta be Prince.
It is Prince.
Nice.
And I'm not talking about the legal aspects of how he changed his name.
I find it baffling.
It is, but I'm not talking about the legal parts of it.
Okay.
Prince Rogers Nelson was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Wait, his actual first name at birth was Prince.
I'll tell you why.
Fucking hell, I thought it was just a stage name that he changed his name to legally.
No.
Holy shit.
That was the symbol.
No, I know, but I thought he... Oh, no. Oh, that's great.
No, you thought he changed his name twice? No. He was born Prince.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
He was born Prince.
That's fucking great.
Prince Rogers Nelson was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota on June 7th, 1958. His mother was a jazz singer and his father was a pianist and songwriter. Prince's name actually came from his father's stage name, Prince Rogers. So there you go.
Oh, it's his dad's stage name.
Yep.
I did not know that. That's great.
Isn't it? Like, that's his real name.
Right? I genuinely thought he was born, you know, like, John William Jackson or something, and, like, changed his name legally to his stage name, Prince, and then changed it to a weird symbol, and then changed it back.
No, he wasn't that crazy. Jeez.
That's phenomenal.
No, his name was Prince.
Okay. I did not know that. I assumed he just had some really boring name and he just came up with a great stage name. But honestly, this is an even better story.
But this is the funny part is that as a kid, he didn't like his name and he told people to call him Skipper, which is so much worse.
Yeah, no, that's way worse.
So much worse.
I'd rather be a prince than a skipper.
Oh, yeah. In high school, he went to the Minnesota Dance Theater and was trained in classical ballet. He also played football, basketball, and baseball in high school.
No kidding.
Yeah. Very well-rounded.
Yeah, wow. When do we get to the part where he plays music?
Now.
Because so far, he's been dancing and playing sports.
Now.
Okay.
In 1975, when he was 17 years old, his cousin's husband started a band called 94 East and hired Prince to record with them on guitar. So I guess he was playing also.
In addition to all the sports and classical ballet, he was already playing guitar.
He was just full of extracurriculars.
Okay, so yeah, so he was, I assume, already playing guitar at a relatively high level at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
The band,
he would, of course, go on to be one of the greatest guitarists in history, but...
The band didn't get a record deal, but his manager helped him make a demo, and he signed a record contract with Warner Brothers.
Okay.
They moved to Sausalito, California, and he recorded his first album, For You. Not For You. The album was called For You.
Oh, he didn't record it for me.
I don't want you to get a big head about it.
All right, that's fair. There's been a lot of Warner Brothers in the past few weeks.
Yeah, I don't know.
Huh.
Prince wrote, produced, arranged, and composed, and played all 27 instruments on the recording except for one song.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah, so he's obviously some sort of prodigy.
Well, he absolutely is a prodigy.
Yeah.
Like I said, he's... maybe one of the greatest guitarists.
Oh yeah,
ever.
Yeah, for sure.
So I mean, yeah, he's an absolute musical genius.
Yeah, the album was released in 1978, and a couple songs charted on the Hot Soul Singles charts, but not very high. I don't know those charts, but anyway.
I assume it is exactly what it sounds like.
Yep. In 1979, he released the album Prince, which went platinum. Its main hits were "Why You Wanna Treat Me So Bad" and "I Wanna Be Your Lover." Then, in 1980, he released the album Dirty Mind, which was sexually explicit and had the single Uptown.
Okay.
In 1981, Prince started a side project with the band The Time, with whom he released four albums between 1981 and 1990. In 1982, he released a double album, 1999, which sold over 4 million copies. Keep in mind, he wasn't even 25 by this point.
Prodigy, like you said.
Yes. Delirious and 1999 placed in the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100, and he earned his first Grammy Award for the song International Lover. I don't, like, know most of these songs. I feel like I need to listen to him.
Yeah.
I know, like, two songs.
I'm recognizing a couple of these, but not as many as I probably should be, considering how influential he is. Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
In 1984, he got a deal to star in the hit film Purple Rain, which was loosely autobiographical,
mm-hmm.
and the soundtrack, also called Purple Rain, spent 24 weeks at number one on the Billboard 200.
So that one I know.
Yeah, everyone knows.
That's a phenomenal song. Yeah, great stuff.
He won the Academy Award for Best Original Song Score for the film. Number one hits from the album included When Doves Cry, Let's Go Crazy, and of course, Purple Rain.
Yeah.
His next album, Around the World in a Day, had the hit singles Raspberry Beret and Pop Life. Like, I've heard of the songs, but I can't think of how they go.
Raspberry Beret is good. I don't think I know Pop Life, but Raspberry Beret is very good.
Okay. Then in 1986, he released the album Parade, which had the hit single Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know that. I don't know. It was the soundtrack for his next film, Under the Cherry Moon, which actually won the Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Picture.
Which we talked about...
twice.
2 years ago or something.
And also when we talked about Xanadu.
Well, yes, but I did an entire discussion on the history of the Razzies, like...
Yes.
I don't remember when, but it was a long time ago. That was fun. I liked that one.
That year, he also wrote the song Manic Monday for the Bengals, which reached number 2 on the Hot 100.
Oh, I hate that
song. Did you know that Prince wrote Manic Monday?
I did.
I didn't.
Which is so bizarre, because he's a very talented...
Just another man. I like that song.
He's a very talented songwriter, and that song is garbage.
I like the Bengals.
Ugh.
I don't know. His next album, Sign of the Times, was released in 1987 and peaked at number 6 on the Billboard 200. He was supposed to release his next album, The Black Album, after that, but after 500,000 copies were made, he had a spiritual epiphany that the album was evil and had it recalled.
And then Jay-Z released The Black Album.
Okay, no. That was, oh yeah, and then there was The Gray Album.
Which was Danger Mouse remixing
right.
Jay-Z's Black Album
okay, you're right.
with the Beatles' White Album.
Well, clearly Jay-Z had a feeling it wasn't evil. So
yeah, Jay-Z's Black Album is really good. Anyway,
we get it. You like Jay-Z.
I like Jay-Z.
Okay. 8 weeks later, he was done recording his next album, Love Sexy, one word, with the lead single, Alphabet Street.
Wait. 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
So he decided...
He was like, this is evil, and I'm going to be really productive and have a new album ready to go 8 weeks later.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah, well, he's a prodigy.
Holy fuck. All right, yeah.
He then worked with Madonna, playing guitar on the songs Like a Prayer, Keep It Together, and Act of Contrition, and also co-wrote and sang the duet Love Song with her. Wow. How have I never heard of this Love Song?
I don't know. I didn't know he was the guitarist on Like a Prayer, but...
How cool is that?
Kind of makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
He then recorded a 9-track album for the 1989 film Batman, which peaked at number 1 on the Billboard 200.
That's right. I did know.
It had the Bat Dance.
A throwback to your last episode about...
Batman.
Batman. But...
Batman. His next album, along with another film, was called Graffiti Bridge. Like the last one, the album did well, but the film was a flop.
Wait, Batman 89 was not a flop.
His next album, along with another film, was called Graffiti Bridge.
Okay.
Like the last film that got the Golden Raspberry, which was called...
Okay.
Under the Cherry Moon.
Oh. So the last time the album shared its name
yes.
with the film.
Okay. Sorry, that was unclear.
I was going to say, Batman 89 was like the biggest movie in the world that year.
Yeah.
So,
No. The last film, like Purple Rain did really well,
right,
and then the
right,
next
right.
two films were not.
Okay, all right, gotcha.
Not so good.
Sorry.
After that, the last members of his band, The Revolution, left, and he started a new band, The New Power Generation. He released the album Diamonds and Pearls in 1991, which did well. His next album in 1992 was the one with Love Symbol number 2. In 1993, he adopted the Love Symbol as his stage name. That's when he was called the artist formerly known as Prince, or just The Artist.
Was it a stage name, though? I thought he legally changed his name.
I don't know. Sorry.
Okay.
You want me to look it up?
No, it's fine.
He thought Warner Brothers was limiting his artistic freedom, and they agreed to release his new album, Come. He left Warner Brothers and had his own NPG Records, with which he released a 3-CD set called Emancipation. He then released Crystal Ball, a 5-CD collection of unreleased material in 1998. In 2000, he went back to using Prince as his name.
Right.
Over the next 4 years, he released the albums Rave Unto the Joy Fantastic. It's to the number 2.
Of course.
The Rainbow Children. One Night Alone... Expectation. C-Note. The Chocolate Invasion. And The Slaughterhouse. I like The Chocolate Invasion. That's my favorite.
Okay.
He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004. He then released the album Musicology, for which he got 2 Grammy wins. His next album, released in 2006, was 3121, which was his first album to debut at number 1 on the Billboard 200.
Really?
Really.
That's surprising that it took that long, but okay.
Yep. That year, he also wrote The Song of the Heart for the film Happy Feet, for which he won a Golden Globe for Best Original Song.
Okay.
You've never seen that.
No.
It's fun.
Why would I?
I don't know. Someday you'll have a kid and you'll watch it. It's fun. It's very, very cute.
Okay.
In 2007, he played at the Super Bowl halftime show.
That was good.
It was really good. That
yeah,
I remember.
I remember that one.
In 2009, he released a triple album combining songs from his online albums, which he called Elixir. In 2010, he released the album 2010, like numbers 20 and then the word 10, and toured Europe. In 2014, he launched NPG Publishing to administer his own music and that of other artists without restrictions of mainstream record companies. In 2015, he released his last 2 albums, Hit and Run Phase 1 and Hit and Run Phase 2. In 2016, he was hospitalized and given Narcan, which counteracts opioid overdose.
Yeah.
He then became conscious and left the hospital against medical advice. About a week later, he was found dead in his home from an overdose of fentanyl at age 57.
Tragic.
Very. Too young.
Yeah. You didn't mention that his home is called Paisley Park, which comes up a lot.
Oh, sorry.
That was the name of his,
you're
like,
right, that is a
palatial
thing.
Estate in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Paisley was a thing.
Yeah.
And purple.
Yes, he was very big into purple, which... I'm sure makes you a fan.
It does.
Okay.
Okay.
So, I got 5 correct answers, so I at least held serve over the past couple of weeks. So now, what's the score? 17 to 15?
I think so.
Okay.
No, wait. Yes, maybe. I don't know. I think so.
It is.
No!
So the season is suddenly much closer than it was a couple of weeks ago. Well, actually, I guess it's exactly as close as it was a couple of weeks ago, but whatever. Whatever. It feels like you've been beating my ass all season, and I finally just closed the gap. Maybe that's not what the numbers say, but that's certainly how it feels.
Okay.
All right, well, anyway.
I need a win.
Anyway, so it is now 17 to 15 on the season with one game apiece left to play. So this is getting good.
Our 99th and 100th episodes.
That is true. Well, yes, if you exclude the weird special episodes. We have like 5 episodes that don't really count. We have a couple of tiebreakers, a couple of guest episodes. But yes, just regular season episodes. That's true. The 99 and 100 are coming up.
Crazy.
Wild.
Yep.
We've been doing this for 2.5 friggin' years.
Yep.
That's crazy.
It's been good.
It's been a good run. Yeah. So that brings us, of course, to Fact or Fucked. And today's Fact or Fucked comes, as they sometimes do, from our good friends Quizotic Mirth. So follow them on Twitter at Quizotic Mirth, QUIZOTICMIRTH. They just post, like, weird facts about stuff. If you like what we do, you will like what they do. Here is what they say. This is several tweets. This is just a bundle of fun from start to swift and stinky finish. That's your prologue.
Okay.
Here's the claim. Until Kate Hoey used parliamentary privilege to reveal its location in 1993, the BT Tower, a very prominent landmark in London, was an official secret for reasons of national security because it was used in communications and was kept off ordnance and survey maps since opening in 1965. And you guys should just Google BT Tower if you want to see what it looks like, but the comment on this picture is hardly inconspicuous. And if you just Googled it, I think you will agree, it is hardly inconspicuous. It is a very, very large tower in the middle of London. And so again, the claim is that it was an official state secret until 1993.
What?
Because it was used in, like, you know, confidential communications by the government.
Sure, why not?
Fact?
Sure, fact.
It's fact.
That's insane. It's huge.
For nearly 3 decades, this gigantic communications array in the middle of London was, like, officially not on any map. It was not even allowed to be referred to by, like, the postal service. The postal service had to refer to it as Location 23. Like, they couldn't refer to it by name because officially it didn't exist, even though it was just, like, this giant thing in the middle of the city.
That's nuts.
So strange. So, anyway.
That's really crazy.
Thank you to our friends across the pond at Quizotic Mirth. That is another just fucking weird British fact that I love. So, thank you guys. Go check them out at Quizotic Mirth on Twitter. You will enjoy everything that they do.
Yep.
All right. I guess that'll do it for this week, then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2 games left to go. 2 correct answers separate us.
Yep.
Now we're in the home stretch for this season, so we will see you guys next week.
Yep.
All right, see you then.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Tantras instruct practitioners on how the mandala should be drawn and indicates the mantras to be recited during the ritual. I'll just say that again.
Yep.
Maybe I should say tantras if I'm going to say mantras. Maybe that's why I got confused.
Okay.
But it's tantric.
Yeah.